we all have people in our lives we disagree with. Maybe you have a close friend who has a different opinion on gun rights, or a family member who disagrees with you on pandemic safety measures. Talking about those disagreements can be really hard. And a lot of times those conversations turn into arguments, and both parties end up more dug into their beliefs. Our next guest says that's because we're trying to go about changing someone's mind all wrong. He says it is possible to persuade someone, but facts and logic won't get us very far. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How do you handle conversations when you disagree with someone? Do you try to argue your point with facts? Has your own mind ever been changed on an issue? If so, how did that change happen? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David McRaney is a science journalist and the host of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. He's written multiple books, including his latest, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. David, thanks for being here.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book was a bit of a personal journey for you. You admit at the start that you were someone who didn't always think it was possible to change a lot of minds. What started changing for you and getting you interested in persuasion?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've run my podcast for like more than a decade now, and I've written about this for a long time. It's been my beat for a while to talk about biases, fallacies, heuristics, and motivated reasoning, judgment, decision-making, all of the psychology and social science, neuroscience that goes into that. And motivated reasoning is, there's a sort of cynicism that can go along with studying that for too long, I think. And I had become very pessimistic about it. The inciting moment for me, those two things combined. I was doing a lecture and someone asked me after the lecture, they said, I have a family member who is falling into a conspiracy theory. What can I do about it? And I told them, nothing, you can't do anything about it. And I didn't even believe it as it came out of my mouth. I didn't like the tone. I didn't like what I was suggesting. And also realized I didn't know enough about the prescriptive side of everything. It was all description, no prescription. So I wanted to dig into that more and give a better answer going forward. And I wish I could get a time machine and go back. But the other thing that happened was, while I was saying that, also the norms around same-sex marriage, the attitudes in the United States were changing very rapidly. And I looked at the polling, and 60% of the country just a few years earlier had been opposed, and now 60% was in favor of same-sex marriage. And I imagined what would happen if you took all of those people in the majority and sent them back 10 years and they had them meet themselves. They would argue, they would debate, they'd get mad at each other. They would refuse to change their minds in the presence of their own selves. And I just wondered, what's that all about? Not only what's going on in the brain when we disagree, but what happened in the interim so that a person after all of that could look back and say, oh yeah, of course I was wrong about that. That was available to them at any time, but something happened to lock it into place. That's what led me down this whole path. And yeah, I really did change my mind. There's a lot of comeuppance in this book about reaching out to people who resist and using better methods and so on.
And something that you found might at first be discouraging to us, and that's that facts, logic, not gonna always work. What are we getting wrong when we try to use those facts and logic?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. You know, there's a lot of frustration, especially right now, because we spend so much time arguing on the internet. And as I say in the book, I think that's good. I think that's a good thing we're all arguing. But the way in which we argue in a lot of our contexts is really poorly done. And we have this intuition about how to reach out to other people. I feel like that frustration should be directed at ourselves more than the other party. It's like trying to reach the moon with a ladder. And then when you fail, saying, well, the moon's unreachable. It's the technique that you're using. It's the approach that you're using. One of the things that makes this not work is that we all start with a motivation, and we go from that motivation, that emotion, that identity, that desire, that drive. We look at all the information available to us and we cherry pick what seems to justify the feeling that we have. And then that becomes our collection of reasons for why we think, feel, and believe something. And when we meet someone who sees things differently, feels differently, we often take something out of that collection and say, this is why I think this, but that's not why you think it. That's a justification that you arrived at later. The reason why you think and feel this maybe something that you aren't even really aware of, that's also happening on the other side. They've done the same thing and they have their collection. And if you just battle it out at the level of those conclusions, at those reasons, those justifications and rationalizations, you never get at why do you feel this way? What causes you to choose that and not something else? Why are you selectively skeptical? So I advocate for it throughout the book that you, instead of facing off against people in that way, get out of the debate frame, the I have to win, you have to lose, someone's right, someone's wrong, and instead try to get shoulder to shoulder, where the goal is invite the other person to participate in a team up exercise to investigate a mystery together, which is why do you think we might disagree about this? And there's a lot more, everything that I talk about in the book, all the different persuasion techniques, all the people that I've met, even the people that have left conspiratorial communities and cults and pseudo cults, this is the technique. This is the conversational approach that delivers the results. Because we all can change our minds, and we all do update our assumptions and entertain other points of view when it's presented in a certain way, when it avoids this reactance, as they call it in psychology. And that's the better path. It's not a book about how to win friends and influence people. It's a very different approach from that sort of manipulation, coercion way of doing things. It's a very different way of approaching another mind that sees things differently.
We're talking with David McRaney right now, a science journalist, host of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, and author of the new book, How Minds Change: The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We're talking about how minds do change and how you can go about it in your own life. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. When you have people you disagree with, how do you talk with them? Have you found a good way to talk across those divides? Has your own mind ever been changed on an issue? We'd love to hear about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, one group you spent some time with were the Deep Canvassers in California. This is really interesting work they've been doing for a number of years now. Can you talk about what deep canvassing is, how it works?
Sure. One of the most fascinating things, I had no idea this was going to happen. It was very surprising. I wanted to spend time with people who professionally change people's minds, and I spent time with deep canvassing and motivational interviewing and street epistemology and all sorts of other groups. All these groups had never met each other. Many of them were aware of psychological literature that would help explain what they did worked, yet they'd all independently come up with sort of the same approach. And if they had steps in their process, the steps were in the same order. And the first group that I met, it was from the leadership lab, at the LGBT Center of Los Angeles. They're sort of the political action wing of that group, and they were trying to understand how Prop 8 had unfolded in California when California voted against same-sex marriage in a state where that just seemed very improbable. And they went door to door to try to figure out what was going on, and they simply asked people at their front doors, "Why did you vote against this issue?" And they were astonished to find that first of all, people were very willing to have that conversation, but also sometimes in talking about the issue, the person at their front door would see it differently by the end of the conversation. So they started recording, and after about 17,000 conversations recorded on video, they A/B tested all of this and threw away what didn't work, kept what did, and they arrived at this really powerful technique they call deep canvassing, which they've now expanded to many different issues, and it's all over the country now. It's not just in California. And it works in a very particular way. I can go through the steps if you'd like, but that's what happened when I went there and canvassed with them, trained in it, went door to door with them, and was just amazed. I went into their archives and watched a lot of the videos and was just astonished to watch people enter the conversation feeling one way and leaving the conversation feeling another. And it's a listening technique more than anything. It's a way to hold space and allow another person to introspect in a very particular way so that they can, in a way, discover their actual belief or their opinion on the matter in a way that isn't received wisdom anymore, isn't signaling in any way, is not an attempt to maintain a reputation or an identity. It's strangely very freeing for the person on the other side.
Yeah, that sounds like it's a really potentially uncomfortable situation. You show up at someone's door and say, hey, let's talk about controversial topic X, Y, or Z. What kind of listening techniques or tools did the canvassers use to sort of get people out of the normal black and white thinking and start getting them to approach it in a different way?
Okay, this is very powerful. And although there are about 9 steps in this, you really only need to come away from this with 2. So anybody listening, these first 2 you can apply today. But the first, you know, they did in their technique, they would knock on a person's door and say hello, and they would build rapport very quickly right off the bat. The idea here is to avoid something in psychology I mentioned earlier called reactance. We all have a really strong motivation to push away any stimulus that threatens our autonomy. And if someone's telling you how to think or how you should think or suggesting you should be ashamed for how you currently think, we will very quickly push back. And then often what happens is then you push back a little harder, and then you enter into a feedback loop that ends with one of these angry, you know, let's agree to disagree kind of things, which I hate that expression, by the way, because obviously we agree to disagree. That's how we started the conversation. The way you get out of this is to assure the other person you're not out to shame them in any way, ask for their consent to explore their reasoning, and be very transparent about what you're up to. And more than anything, express you are curious about why they feel the way they feel, how they feel about the issue at hand. Most people, when it's framed that way, are very eager to then share their view on the issue. And then they take whatever the issue is in particular, and this is the really incredible part of this, is ask, how do you feel on this issue on a scale from 0 to 10? If it's a fact-based issue, you can ask, what's your level of certainty? How certain are you? How confident are you that this is true? But if it's an attitude-based issue, a political issue, oftentimes a wedge issue, you can say, well, like if it's gun control, for example, like a 10 would be all guns in the country need to be destroyed, and if you're found with one, it's a death penalty. And 0 would be you should get a free gun in the mail every week. Where are you on that scale? And oftentimes, this is all it takes to have the conversation that I'm talking about. You can imagine, just if I ask you the last movie that you watched, what would you give it on a scale? If you ask you how did you like it, you'll say yes or no. But if I ask you where would you put yourself on the scale, you say maybe a 7. Then I ask, why a 7? You can feel that feeling that most people have. We begin to think in a very different way. On one of these issues, they ask that, and then if the person is a 7 on the issue, they can ask, why do you feel that way? But then they can also say, why not a 6, why not a 5, or why not an 8, why not a 10? And this all comes from motivational interviewing, though they weren't aware that's where it comes from, a therapeutic technique where if a person wants to move away from a particular side of that spectrum, you can ask them, why aren't they closer to that side? And oftentimes people will produce their own counterarguments they may never have articulated before. And those counterarguments will be something that adds weight to feeling differently about it. In deep canvassing, the next thing they usually do is they share a story about someone who's affected by the issue. Often they show a video. Then they ask for that number a second time. If it's moved, they ask, well, why did it move? And what they're doing constantly here is holding space, not non-judgmentally, compassionately listening to the other person and giving that person a chance to say, why do I feel this way? Why did I move? Why does that number feel right to me? And always repeat it back in their own words, use that or person's definitions if they have them, and summarize and repeat in such a way that they feel like they're really being heard and they're really starting to get a chance to truly articulate how they feel. And then you can go further to say, is there a time in your life before you felt that way? Are there examples from your life where you have actually been close to this issue? If not, you'll start to see that it's very received wisdom. If so, oftentimes those stories come into conflict with the attitude that you're portraying. And you just listen in this way. You continuously hold that space. And then at the end, you can share your own story. At the end, you can show where your perspective is at. But you say it in such a way, you say, well, you know, it's fascinating. I find you a very intelligent and reasonable person. It's odd that I see it differently than you. I wonder why we see it so differently. You know, from my perspective, this, this, and this. And at no point in any of that is an argument taking place. At no point are you trying to copy and paste anything out of your head into their head. And they have an incredible success rate with this approach for shifting people around on many different wedge issues.
We're talking with science journalist David McRaney about his new book, How Minds Change. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you found a good way to talk across divides? Has your own mind been changed on an issue? Why was that? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with science journalist David McRaney, here today to talk about his book, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Let me make a little quick comment here. I wrote a musical with Warren Casey, the man who wrote Grease. And when you write a musical, you ask the audience, well, how did you like this show, or what did you think about this show? And they always tell you, they tell you what they think you want to hear. And then what he would say, well, how can I make it better? And once you ask them how to make it better, then they say, well, the costume was wrong, and the music was a little bit off, and this was a little bit there, and this was a little bit there. And you finally get to what they really thought about the, your question in the first place. But that's one way of, you know, getting the truth out of people. But the next question I wanted to ask is, if you want to change somebody's mind, do you use logic, go straight at them with logic, or do you skirt around the logic and go in a different direction to kind of change it? It's really, it seems like you can't change people's minds.
Got it, Tom. Thanks for the call. David, Tom, thinking like many people, that logic mm-hmm. should be the place we start. As you've been saying, understanding and getting at experiences and motivations seem to be the more productive way, at least to start understanding each other.
Yeah, you can't go in with logic and facts unless you're in one of these environments where that's sort of the rules of the game. Like a good faith environment where, you know, hey, we're going to get behind lecterns, we're going to be in front of an audience, or we are in a scientific circle where we go with hypothesis testing and null hypothesis and evidence, and we're going to go with theories and models, and I'm going to vet you, you're going to vet me. There are plenty of places where that's the right approach. There are philosophical domains where we would go with propositions and use logic almost like a mathematical language. It's a great tool. It's an amazing thing. It's a great invention of human talent. But most of the time when we're having conversations with people, especially face-to-face, we're going to fall back on much more primates, ultra-social primate evolutionary domains of how people parse language and understand things. And we're going to really have to deal with justifications, you know, like you can think of it like this, like when a person is falling in love with somebody, all the things that they say, why am I falling? Why do I like this person? It'd be like the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they cut their food, the music they listen to, the TV shows they like. Then when they're breaking up with that person, they'll say, why are you breaking up with them? Well, because of the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they cut their food, the dumb music they listen to, the dumb TV shows. The reasons remain the same. The facts remain the same, but the motivation has changed, and the thing we say is the reason for or against can be the exact same reason. And that's also true in an argument. That's why in psychology, reasoning should not be confused with reason, the philosophical concept of like intellect and rationality. In psychology, reasoning is simply coming up with reasons for what you think, feel, and believe. We're very good at that. You have to get a step behind that process if you want to get at why a person actually is choosing those reasons out of all the other things they could be saying. And that's the place where you're trying to move the conversation and the techniques that I'm talking about in the book. And I would also note that what your example of, if you ask people why they didn't like it, the play, like you're doing sort of the inverse of what you should do in a motivational interviewing environment, because you're asking them to give you reasons for why they don't like it, and they will. And then they'll walk away with all that articulation. And it's one of those things where if they were a 7 in the movie, you would ask, why not a 4, why not a 3? And now they'll produce arguments in the other direction. Well, I did like this, I did like that, I did like this. And they'll walk away from the conversation having articulated reasons for liking the thing instead of against it.
David, we just have a couple of minutes left, but before we run out of time, I'd like to touch on the story of Charlie that you mentioned in the book. He was a 9/11 conspiracy theorist, very deep, very high profile in that world. Came out of it, though, renounced the conspiracy theories. What changed his mind?
Yeah, I explore a couple of people like that in the book. I go to Westboro Baptist Church. I spent time with the Moonies and anti-vaxxers, flat earthers, and Charlie, who is a 9/11 truther, he was. He went on a conspiracy road trip television show, actually, with a group of other people who shared his conspiratorial beliefs. But he was the only one who changed his mind. The others actually walked away from getting all this evidence. They went to the crash sites. They flew airplanes. They did all sorts of things that you would love to do with a person who is deep into conspiracy theory, to show them these really raw facts. And they went away feeling even more strongly about it, whereas he went the other way. He changed his mind. I was very curious about this, and after spending time with people who left conspiratorial groups and cults and pseudo-cults, pretty much the same thing usually happens. There's a onboarding process where people usually have some sort of anxiety or identity issue, or they have some sort of need for validation, or a prejudice that the conspiratorial community that they fall into helps them take those things and solves those drives. It meets their needs in a certain way. And then after that, it's just the community that they stick around for. They really want to stay in that group of people and stay in that group hug. The way out, though, the offboarding process, the off-ramp, for everyone I spoke to and that I met, typically someone outside of that group was non-judgmentally offered to listen to them and see their point of view and revealed to them that there were other groups outside of the group that they were in that they could affirm their values within. And it helps a person see that I do have these core values that are separate from the group, and they could be met in a different way in a different group. And once a person has that sort of social safety net, they have a foot in more than one social world, then all of the inconsistencies and the things that frustrate them and the things about the group that they're in that normally that they would forgive start to become a little bit more unforgivable. In Charlie's case, he was hugging people who had lost family members.
David, I'm so sorry. We were just about out of time. Thanks to our guest, David McRaney, author of the new book, How Minds Change.